The following is an unrehearsed interview with Mr. Ted Urey by Debbie Wilson for the Kentucky Oral History Commission. The interview was conducted at the Bell County Middlesboro Library on June 27, 1978 at 4 o'clock p.m. The first thing I want to start with, Mr. Urey, is just something of your personal background. Now, what's your full name?
My name is Ted T. Urey.
And where were you?
I was born and reared in Middlesboro, in the western end of the section of the city of Middlesboro, which is known as the Junction. And there I was born and reared and was schooled in the public schools of Middlesboro until I reached my adult age of seeking employment, and with the first job that I had was with the Middlesboro Fire Department. Although my father was a coal miner and a businessman owning and operating a grocery store, and of course working as a foreman in the mines, and but I sought not to follow any of those occupations that he had, and I became interested in the city government, and therefore I have come to the place where I wanted to serve as an official in the city government.
Well, now, when were you born?
I was born on May 30th, 1917.
Who's your wife?
I married the former Ina Lee Byrd, the daughter of Doyle E. Byrd of this city, a former city commissioner with the city of Middlesboro in the years of 1938 and 39.
You had
when the city of Middlesboro was under the commission form of government.
What form of government does it have now?
It has the councilmatic form of government now. It is governed by the mayor and 12 city councilmen. The commission form of government composed of a mayor and 2 city commissioners.
Now, when did the system change?
The system changed in 1942, I believe, if my memory serves me right. The city of Middlesboro voted to change from the commission form of government to the councilmatic form of government. This was due to the city was growing somewhat, or had begun to grow a little in its population, and the form of government they felt would be better being a councilmatic form. They would have more representatives to represent the people by having 12 councilmen than 2, which proved to be much better because 2 people seemingly could agree more easily on something, whether it was good or whether it was not so good. And the 12 men and women that served in the different years that served, why, of course, it worked out better because it gave a majority of opinions and different things that they could come up with and have a better form of government. And under the commission form of government, in the early days, the city was, of course, in the days of Prohibition, and things were so wide open and lawlessness, and with the prohibition and with other things that followed, such as prostitution and illegal things that happened, the people became to began to get alarmed about these things, and the citizens began to speak out more so than they had in the past, and they began to see that there was a need of a change and a better form of government and a more conservative form of government, we might say, concerning the monetary system. And of course, it brought on this change. And then when World War II came on, still under a prohibition and the outbreak of the war and the things that were going on in Middleboro, it was pretty rough. It wasn't really safe during those days, and with many soldiers returning back on furloughs and the town so wide open, it really wasn't safe for a mother or a daughter to walk the streets, especially at night. It was rough in those days. And the councilmatic form of government then took steps afterwards that they came into office after these things had passed, and seeing the needs of them, they took steps to improve the city, to spread out and to do things that would invite industry and to give better protection. When I was employed with the city of Middleboro, I of course worked integrated some with the police department. Some times I served with them and helped them in different times of need when there was emergency, but not very often, because I did not choose that at all for my employment. I was not interested, but yet we had to do what we were asked to do. And I can remember where and when there were incidents between returning soldiers that were they were drunken, and they were had been away in training camps, and as young soldiers would be, they would get liquored up to the point where they were really rough. And I know that there were several, or not several, but there were a few that had incidents with the police department. There were one or two that had that the police department, some members of the police department, were put to a point where that they had shootouts and some were killed, and it was really rough. The police department was not large enough to handle the inflow of the traffic that was coming into the city at that time. And there were only four policemen, and then, of course, they would add additional help over the weekend, like they would hire two extra policemen and maybe pull a fireman off to help serve. And it was wide open, and they had a place here, what they call the Wabash Hotel, where it was headquartered for. A lot of the soldiers would go in and out, and the slot machines were in operation here, and it was just what we would say really a rough time. And with the city not large enough to have the manpower, of course, that they needed to cope with all of this, well, they had their problem, but yet they did a very good job. And at that time also, the communication system was not as it is today. We didn't have the modern communication system that we have radio today, and as it is so set up and so easily to communicate and to get in touch with each other. At that time, we had on the City Hall building, there was a tower that had a bell in the top of this tower, approximately 40 feet high above the City Hall building. And the only way that we communicated, the policemen could not stay in the office. They had to be out on the streets and be working all the time. And the firemen took all incoming calls by telephone. And both police and fire calls. Then we had a system where if we wanted to get a hold of the chief of police, we would tap this bell twice, and the chief would hear the bell and he would call in to see what the call was. If we were to get a hold of the patrolmen, we tapped the bell three times and they would hear the bell, then they would call in and we would relay the call to them and they would answer from there. And if we had a fire call, we tapped the bell one time and the firemen knew if they were, and they were only at that time four of us, four firemen, and if they one were or was away to their meal or so on, he would hear the bell and he would call in. And then if it was of course the citizens and the businessmen helped us quite a bit then to give protection to their property and their homes, and they would volunteer to help. And many times the businessmen would call too because they knew what the ring was, and they would call to find out what the fire was or where it was or what type it was or how large, and then of course they would respond and help us. But that was the system that we had in the early days that I began with the city.
You were mentioning all this violence now with these World War II soldiers. Why did you have so many soldiers in Middlesboro?
Well, you remember, you probably don't, but at the time the war broke out and was declared, or at the time the war was declared, then the soldiers, of course, everybody was registered, and you was required to serve, and they were really calling them to service so fast out of the city here and the surrounding areas of Virginia, Fondy, Kentucky, and all around about us. This was a central location, and the selective service system was in Middlesboro for this vicinity, and all draftees were sent from here to Huntington, Virginia, or some other locality to be examined for service. And then they were given, when they entered service, then they were given, after they had been in service for 90 days, they were given a 30 days furlough, whereby that they could come back and visit their family, because they were shipping them overseas just as fast as they could get them. The war was so bad, and they were not prepared, so they were shipping them out fast, but they did give them this furlough. And then they would come into the city from Lee County, Virginia, Claiborne County, Tennessee, and Fondy, Kentucky, all these surrounding counties. They flowed into here because this town, of course, was an open town for whiskey and all the other types of evil that was here, you might say, in which a young man that thought he was going to service and be killed or didn't know where he's coming back or not, I'll leave it up, I'll have a good time. I think that's what drew so many of them into Middlesboro, because it was under those conditions that we lived.
Well, you mentioned that there was a lot of liquor here. Now, were the distilleries and the brewery, were they still here at this time?
No, the distilleries and the breweries were not. There was one place that processed or hauled in, but the stores were legal. There was about every other store on 19th Street or in that section of the city was a liquor store. And anybody could buy, it was legal, you could buy it. It was a wet town, it was not dry like it is now. It was wet, it was legal town, and whiskey stores, they could buy it anywhere. So just about every other place in the city was a whiskey store. And of course, with whiskey, you know, goes every other vice. There was gamblings, and there was prostitution and everything that goes on in any wide open town, which you've read about or known about, I guess.
Well, was Middlesboro alone wet, or was the whole county wet at this time?
The whole county.
Well, now, when did Middlesboro or Bell County, either, when did they go dry?
I don't remember the exact year that whiskey was voted out, but I would say it was in the late 40s that voted out legal whiskey, and it's been dry ever since, but I don't remember the exact year.
Was there much struggle in this wet, dry election? Did that cause any uproar?
Well, whiskey was voted out after the war was over, and the returning soldiers came home, and all after that whiskey was voted out. There was, of course, in the voting of the whiskey out or voting the city dry, you had the problem of those that were interested in the wets and those that were interested in the dries, and there was quite a fight to vote it out. There was legal procedures after the vote was taken through the courts, which did not stand up. It really was voted out, but you still have these things when you're in a situation like that, because those that are for the opposition, they don't give up easily either. But since that time, then there was one or two different times later that after so many years, I think 3 years, they were allowed another election. And to my remembrance, I believe we had two after it was voted out, and both times afterward it was voted down again.
Didn't we have one, excuse me, not mine, do you?
No, go ahead.
Didn't we have one about a year ago?
No, it's been about, it's been approximately 4 or 5 years ago.
I know. We had one since we moved down here. Voting whether Bell County is going to be dry or not.
I think you'll find that it was approximately 4 years ago. Time flies
by. Well, now, while we're still on wet and dry and liquor, what about the moonshining situation now? Was that a big problem? Is it a problem?
The moonshining situation was not a problem under legal liquors. Too much. There was some that went on. There were people that bought the bootleg whiskey, which was a cheaper type of whiskey, that could not afford the higher priced or better whiskey. But it didn't prove such a great problem, because you had this legal whiskey. And then through the legal whiskey, they had a cheap type of whiskey and a cheap type of wine, whereby that those that could not afford the higher priced whiskey, then they soon left the bootleg whiskey and went to this cheap wine. And you've heard the remarks made, I guess, recently about winos. It is a cheap type of whiskey that they get on and use it continually. Very cheap. But no, the legal, the unlegal, or the bootleg whiskey wasn't a great problem after the legal whiskey came in. It was a tremendous problem, I understood, by father and other older people in the days before that legal whiskey was, or legal whiskey came in, there was quite a bit of bootlegging, I understand, and whiskey selling, and people that had power over different types of bootleg whiskey, and they were in kind of war with each other, such as in one section of town there would be a group that controlled or sold and operated bootleg whiskey, and another group maybe in the western end of town. Sometimes they would conflict with each other and cause trouble between themselves, but it was more of a personal fight between the revenue men sometimes and these people, and then sometimes between themselves as opposition to their businesses.
You hear a lot of stories about revenuers now. Do they really shoot them all
well,
such as this?
Revenuers did. They were, well, revenue officers were legal officers. The government or state officials that were hired by the state, paid by the state, or paid by the federal government. And of course, they would search out or get the information as to where stills operated, where they made the whiskeys at. Most of the time it was made in the mountains, or maybe in some abandoned coal mine, or some place where it could be hid, where the smoke from the boilers and things didn't signal where a certain one was, and they operated at night. But they gathered this information, and then when they would go to raid these places, sometimes there were shootouts, according to the older people. Some were killed, and sometimes the only thing that happened was that they shot up the stills and took axes and bursted up their containers that held the liquors, and that was about the story on the illegal whiskey.
I'll ask you one more thing about the Second World War. Did Bell County or Millsboro, did they lose a lot of men in this war?
Yes, they were a number of men that died from the city of Middleborough and surrounding communities, and I don't know just the exact number, but there were several that lost their lives from this locality here. I know that we had one boy in particular from the city of Middleborough that was in the Marine Corps, and he lost his life in the South Pacific from the city here. And then there were some, there was a sailor boy that was from one of the old line families of this city, the Rostons, that lost his life on a ship that sank by the Japanese. And well, there were many others, but I just can't recall now who they were by names. Most of them I knew personally. They were fine boys and just gotten to the age where they would really become adults, and then this war came up and those things happened.
Well, now, what about the situation in Middlesboro during the Great Depression? Now, at that time, were you a member of the fire department?
Not in the beginning of the Depression, I wasn't. But during the latter part of the Depression, I did. There became a vacancy, and I did get a job with the city. And I began, of course, my employment began with the city as I was hired as a street foreman and working the city prisoners. And I worked at in that capacity for about a year, and then this vacancy came on the fire department by the death of a fireman, and then I got into the fire department and began there, and that was in the latter part of 1938. But prior to that time, the Depression, in Middleboro being a small town and not very much employment at all, about only there were only about two to three places that would hire or could hire, which was a hose foundry and the Middleburg Tanning Company. Then there were a few coal mines, but they already had their employees and there was no openings. Then the government come along with a work program, which was called the WPA under President Roosevelt, that began to hire men to work, and it was really, people were really in need. There was not due to it being their fault, but it was due to the economy and the system that the world, the nation had gotten in, that caused people to be in need of work and money, and they just, it just wasn't there. So the government instituted a program whereby that they paid a man a dollar a day to work on these projects, and one of the projects was to clean out the canal that came through the city of Middleboro. Other projects were to work in certain places where there was need of probably drainage or some place like that, anywhere that they could work, and they let the city operate this program, or the money was furnished through the city and the city government operated this and would hire men and they would work under that. But until the government did that, one particular time it got pretty bad here, to where some people were so desperate in need of food that they came to town and were going to go into the stores and take what they need, because they were just about on starvation, and you could see and feel why they would. Then there was the city officials, the mayor and commissioners, and the city judge and city prosecuting attorney, and a few of the businessmen got together, and they raised some money, or they got together and spoke to these men and met with them, and then they raised some money whereby that they had a little, very little that they had themselves, I would say, but they did compile it together or put it together and raised enough money to give to this group of people of around 100 people that had come to town, whereby that they could buy some food for their families. And they worked like that and did what they could until the government stepped in and helped supply a program whereby that men could work, and from there on it would grow, it growed, and they would go in, they went into buying limestone rock and crushers, and the city built a tile plant out near the airport section of the Middleboro, where they made tile to use in the city streets and different things like that, and hard men. Any way that they could work and have some kind of employment for them, they did, and then they began to build streets, the hard surface part that would eventually be blacktop. They did this all under WPA work, government supplying the money and the city purchasing trucks and hiring individuals to work, and began to pull out little by little. It began to pull out of the depression, and of course through the government's power to see this need and release money and do things all over the United States, eventually pulled out of the depression.
It was the miners, is that what you're saying, that had to get on these work programs?
Miners or any other people, even some that had little rural farms that were that they could probably raise just a little to eat, but they had no money to buy clothing or shoes for their children to go to school or anything, and they were in need of those things as well as food. So it was a collective thing. It didn't identify the miners only, but you might say the whole citizenry of whatever occupation that they've fallen.
Pardon me, I'm going to turn this tape over. Of an interview with Mr. Ted Yeary. Now, Mr. Yeary, just go ahead and tell me what else you'd like to about the Great Depression. Do you have any more memories?
Well, I don't have too much more comment about the Depression. I believe we've pretty well covered it as far as concerning the part of it here in Middlesboro. After the Depression, we might go into some of the advancement of the city of Middlesboro. I believe we have already stated the forms of government, and of course the councilmatic form of government, which has proven to be much more successful than the old commission form of government, of which I started my employment with the city of Middlesboro when one of the early settlers, the late Dr. W. Gavins, was mayor of Middlesboro, and George W. Schaffner and Doyle E. Byrd served as commissioners, and I worked under the commission form of government for about 4 years altogether before we voted in the councilmatic form of government. And then after the councilmatic form of government came in, the city began to go forward by employing a specialist to make surveys of the city and the needs of the city, and to employ people concerning the slum areas, and to get money that would be coming from the federal government to help rebuild and do away with the older buildings and the slum housings. And then from there on, they went to acquiring industrial sites for factories, and to create and interest businesses to come to Middlesboro, and Middlesboro begin to grow. And as Middlesboro began to grow, then of course the liabilities become greater upon the city to furnish more money for the needs, and of course liabilities to the individuals and businessmen becomes greater, and they find that they are in need of more finances too. Then of course the underwriters which write insurance for the protection of the businessman and for the individual citizens, they have requirements also, because they have great risks in insuring the insurees, and there again the city had to find means to employ more employees as policemen and firemen, and to find money to supply and to buy equipment for both departments along with other departments such as street departments and the other departments, executive departments, and all these things begin to grow, and more money is required and more additional help. And I saw then the city as a whole, and especially the fire department, grow from 3 men unto 20 men, and the police department from 4 men unto 20 to 25 policemen as they have today. When I first started as a rookie fireman, there was a fire chief, assistant chief, and one fireman, and then I was hired as the fourth fireman. After that, then as the city was growing, we had one, at that time we had one fire truck, one pumper, a 1917 model white pumper was all that the city had, and they had bought it in the year of 1917. Prior to that, and with information furnished me by the previous fire chief, they had used a hose cart which was pulled by men to the seat of the fire, and of course with very few fire hydrants in the city of Middleburg, the hose was connected and by hand, and then unreeled off the reel, and drug then by hand or pulled by hand to the scene of the fire. There was not very many fires because there was not very many buildings in the business district then, but they did have a few fires occasionally. Then after the disposal of the hose cart, which was manned by men, the city bought a horse-drawn steam pumper, which was pulled by 2 big Western Norman horses. They were housed in the fire department quarters, and the fire chief lived over the department, over the fire quarter department where the equipment was housed. And up in his quarters, next to him was a storage place where they kept the hay and the food, of course, for the horses too. They had to feed them. And the steamer was fed by fuel, which was wood. This was pre-laid, what we call a pre-laid fire. The wood was there, and the oil to start it with, to throw on it, kerosene to start it, and it was pre-laid. And when an alarm would come in, they would sound a gong bell, and the horses were so trained that they would run to the pumper and back up to the pumper, and the harness that they pulled by was swinging the ceiling above them with latched up with a hook, and you pull the cord, and the harness dropped on top of the horses, and then the firemen fastly hooked them up. It was a very fast job, and in the meantime they threw a match to the steamer and started the fire. And by the time that they get to the scene of the fire, this boiler was built in such a way that the fire had built up enough steam that would cause the pump to be in progress, where the pump would pump the water from the hydrant into the hose, and would give pressure to knock down the fire, because you had to have pressure to knock down blazes when they were pretty strong. So that piece of equipment they had and kept until they bought the modernized fire pumper, which we just mentioned. And then that pumper was used until the year of 1926. There was a department with the State Department of Insurance, which of course set the rates per $100 insurance that you or an insurer would have. If you had $1,000 worth of insurance, you paid a percent per $100. It may cost you 8 cents for the first $100, or 8 cents for each $100, depending on the rate that the insurance bureau set in Frankfurt. And that's what you paid for your insurance. Then insurance, of course, as fires or the loss from fires, insurance rates would increase as they do today due to the loss, to, and they would fluctuate as accordingly as the loss ratio would be, but whether it was up or down. And then the insurance rating bureau, they demanded what protection the city had to give to keep this certain insurance rate down at a low rate where the insurer could carry the insurance. If they did not do this, then the insurance rate would be raised so high that you could not carry the maximum insurance that you ought to carry because you could not afford it. And if you had a loss in, you would be at a great loss. You would not collect only what little insurance you had, and it may not be a tenth of what your loss really was. So they demanded that the city add additional equipment, additional men, and as each city grows, you've seen your larger cities grow, and how that each year goes by, there is a great demand for more. That's what happened, and that was what did happen in Middleburg. Then in 1940, the city had to buy another fire truck, which was a 1941 Ford Pumper, and it was delivered in 41. And then they were requiring the city to add additional employees, of which they had not the money to do so under the tax rate program that they had and the income that they had. So the war was ended, and the boys were returning back then in 44 and 45, and the government set up a program to hire returning veterans, and the city would hire these, the city could hire these firemen, train them, and the government paid for all of this training and their salaries up to 2 years. So the city took advantage of that, and by so doing, they hired four returning firemen, and then they would hire additional as they were required. This stayed in effect for a number of years until each one had their full training of the number of years that the government would pay for them, and then some would stay on with the department, some would, by that time the economy was getting better, jobs were becoming open, and they would seek employment elsewhere. But afterwards then, the city had expanded, the industry had come, better streets were being built, they had bought property for industry, and businesses were coming to town, and then local mercantile businesses were coming in and filling the empty buildings, and the population were beginning to grow, and things were improving tremendously. Then the demand for better schools came, and better programs had to be initiated there, and the department was required then to add additional men and inspectors, fire inspectors, and which we did most of that the chief had to do. And we were required to inspect hospitals, schools, along with all the factories and different types of inspections, categorically for the type of industry or whatever it was that we were inspecting, went under different specifications. And those things were required to help keep insurance rates down, and of course to give better protection for the people and safety of lives and things. And those things the city did agree and did put into service. Then, of course, as the industrial sections were growing, and the industrial planners that the city hired to plan for the protection and so on that had to be met, that was required then additional fire station in the western end of town, which the city of course built this station and man did, and at the time that then that I had become fire chief in 1958 at the death of Chief Nibbs, we had gotten to the place where that we had built this new station. We had wrote specs, specification for our new fire equipment. We bought three new pumpers. We bought a 75-foot aerial ladder. We housed the two stations and equipped them with men. And at the time that I retired with the city of Millerville, we had 18 full-time paid firemen and 20 volunteer firemen, which answered calls when the alarms came in and they were called upon. We had modern communications systems between our units and the fire department headquarters, and the city had grown and advanced, and population had increased, new homes were being built, and today Middlesbrough is a nice city and is a good city, and it is still a growing city. And changing then, times changes, and with things changing as they are today, and with this city as a coal industry is so booming now, and in the early years the history of Middlesbrough of course was laid off or was surveyed out to be a 50,000 population city. The English people that surveyed and laid out the city of Middlesbrough anticipated this, knowing the coal industry and all, and they assumed that it would be sooner than it actually happened. But then throughout these years of time, it is happening as they foresaw it to be, and is beginning to happen now, to whereby that this coal industry is going to cause this town to be a boom town, and will, I feel, eventually reach approximately 50,000 population. Now, anticipate that on the fact that through the strip mining that is being stripped, and through some knowledge that I have now of men that is looking forward and are building and are going to build housing units upon certain places where strip, the coal has been stripped and leveled off, and they're now beginning to build housing units or development housing projects. And also, I understand that they are anticipating a resort type system in one section of the mountains here once they have gotten to the place that this particular locality is leveled off and the coal has been removed. And then also there is some farms, some farmland that there where the coal has been stripped out and the land leveled off, and they are making farms out of them and sowing them in Christ, and there's cattle that's being placed on these. And so really to me now, the future is just really beginning to do what these early settlers and these English people that came here and foresaw it to do. They didn't see it in their day, but to me, I can see that it is going to be as they so thought it would be.
Well, now, just how long were you fire chief? You said you started in 1958 as fire chief. Now, how long did you serve in that capacity?
I served 10 years. I retired in 1968, having completed 30 years of service with the city. Beginning as a rookie fireman, I worked up to captain, and then at the retirement of the assistant chief, the former assistant chief, and at the death of the former fire chief, then the city appointed me fire chief, and I served in that for 10 years, reaching my 30 years of continuing service with the city and retiring then. At that, it was in an early age, but beginning with as an early age with the city, I got this time in, and with the city growing and with men that I trained and taught and had, that was able to take over, and with younger men that were able to go forward, I felt with the strain and stress that I'd been through, I'd fought some large fires in the city of Middlesbrough, many business buildings, four or five business buildings that were destroyed back in the 50s that we kept confined, keep from losing the whole city blocks, and through all those years of service. And at that time, the responsibility of the fire chief was great, and I was away from my family as it was growing up. I had two daughters. We had two daughters. When I first began working with the city of Middlesbrough, with the few men that we had, we worked day and night. In other words, I went to work at 7 o'clock of the morning. And I worked throughout the day and through the night, going to lunch, had dinner with an hour off, and supper with an hour off, back at night, and then going to breakfast with an hour off. That, well, I did that for about 4 years. And then, of course, they begin to give us a day and night off, and from there on, of course, things improved and got better, but still the strain of being on call both day and night and going out at all hours of the night. And I figured that I had served and I had enjoyed it, and the citizens of Middlesbrough respected me. They still do many times. I don't come to town too often, but many times I do return back, and the businessmen that I knew, that's not young men now that's taken over, but the older businessmen and citizens still, I walk in and they'll still say, speak to me as they did then. But I've appreciated being able to serve and through those years, and I don't know, somehow or other, I didn't really, at that time, I didn't think I would really be in that position. I had aspirations otherwise, but when I got into it, through the Depression and then the war coming on, and was always thinking possibly that most any time I would be asked to serve, and in the service, that you could not leave a job and go north where they were really making money then, and go in other fields. So I stayed with that. Fortunately, I did not have to go to the service. Well, I would have gone if the war had went on. I would have had to, but due to the being in this department, I did not have to go away to service. And then after the war was over, I had in so many years that I just almost had to stay with it. But then after I retired, of course, through my years after I became chief, I had a little more time off and a little more leisure time. I did quite a bit of work in the religious work of the Church of God and the Pentecostal movement of churches. And after I retired, I put more time to that type of field of work, which I was interested in. But I took, immediately after I retired, I knew that the pension system and the retirement that I would receive would not be enough really to supply as I would be needed to have in my life. And so I took a job with this independent school system of Middlesboro, driving school bus. And I've been driving for the Middlebury Independent School for the last 10 years, since I, almost 11 years since I retired and left the fire department, which doesn't take too much time and gives me more time then to work in the things that I desire to do. I have a little farm, of course, outside the city, or out in the city limits, but in the suburbs of the city, and I enjoy working a little in that, and I stay pretty active yet, and I feel like that by the help of the good Lord, I still have maybe a few years before me that I can do some things. I'm still interested in Middlesboro, in the city of Middlesboro. I'm interested in doing what I can and serving if I am called upon in anything that I might be able to help somebody in.
I want to go back and discuss fires and the fire department a little more. You mentioned that there were few structures in the early days, but now, what were these structures made of? I mean, how have codes changed over the years, and you know, building codes to prevent fires?
In the early years, the structural buildings were all frame buildings, what we call frame buildings, wood frame buildings. And of course, from time to time, they would reface these things or give them a new facelifting. There would be bricks added or whatever it would take, sometimes metal fronts or different things. And some of the buildings, the original buildings, were of brick, though. The older buildings, such as the A.D. Campbell building on Cumberland Avenue and the old Evans Hospital building where the Prairie and Pope drugstore is, and some of those buildings were brick. Campbell buildings were brick, and the Montgomery Ward building was built of stone, and the bank building, some of those that came on later, but the earlier ones were frame buildings. Of course, the 18 and The 1890 fires just about wiped out most of those buildings. Still, these buildings, of course, which were brick veneer, or even if they had solid masonry walls, the inside partitions were wood. And some of those did not have firewalls between each building, which are closely together. As you know, in each city, each building is against each other. And there were no firewalls between them. If a fire was in one building, it could easily spread through this fabricated wall into the next one, and it would spread to whereby you could lose a city block before you really know where the origin of the fire was and where it was spreading to. So after the city began to set up their inspection programs and begin to demand more and better buildings and better protection, then in our inspections we would find these where these walls were not protected, and then they were required to go in and seal off this to make this one building's complete separated from the fire in another one, keeping it from spreading. So we did that. But now many times fires, we could do that in the inside wall, but when you got into the attic of buildings, up in the, where the roof was, in the, what we call the attic, and the fires would go up and spread, then to the roof and would spread over and come down. And then, we, of course, that was where the fire department had to be trained and had to know where the fire was and how to attack that fire and how to cut it off if it was spreading over or in other buildings. We had one particular fire in the Slusher building on the corner of Fountain Square here in Middlesboro. I remember it. This building housed four or five businesses. And one morning, early morning, there was a fire in I believe it originated in a barber shop, and was spread all over this building into each store that was in this particular building, which was a large building. And it had reached to a point where it was so hot and so high that a fire, when it begins to roll, it will begin to make its own oxygen by the rolling of the flames and the fierceness of it. And it had spread it all over the entire building, and it had endangered the whole entire block from the Fountain Square on 20th Street to 21st Street going west. And we attacked that fire with hose lines, and we fought from the top of other buildings, but we could not control it. And I had not been in charge as fire chief but a little while, but we had an old nozzle, what we called a Deluse nozzle, that the fire department had, and I somehow felt that I would need this thing, and I drug it out. I had it mounted on one of the fire trucks, whereby that I could use it. I don't know why, but I felt like that sometime and that I was going to be needing it, because I was very conscientious in this firefighting business, and I guess suffered somewhat being over conscientious in it.
I'm going to change tapes. Excuse me just a minute. The following is tape 2 of an interview with Mr. Ted Urey by Debbie Wilson for the Kentucky Oral History Commission. The interview was conducted at the Bell County Middlesboro Library on June the 27th, 1978 at 5:30 p.m. Now, Mr. Yuri, we were discussing the Slusher fire. So just go ahead and continue the story about that.
Concerning this nozzle, of which I mentioned as a Deleuze nozzle, we called it a fire gun, we might say, because of the capacity of pressure that it would produce. This was to be connected to the pumper on the fire engine, and the pumper, of course, was connected to the local fire hydrants. The local pump produced the gallons per minute plus pressure at the nozzle of pounds per square inch. We connected three 2.5-inch holes to this nozzle, which had the intake of three openings to take the 3.5-inch hose and discharged out one end of this nozzle, producing a power per square inch up to 150 to 175 pounds per square inch of water flow. And due to this fire and the type that it was and the building being connected to the other buildings and could have swept through this entire section, wiped up this block, this nozzle paid a tremendous price in the saving of this block, because with this nozzle mounted and with the action that we were able to work it with, we could just cut this building completely loose from the other with the water pressure by knocking the bricks, doors, windows out. And so that did pay off. I somehow felt like it would be needed, and it did pay off, and we were congratulated by many business people and commended in that job of saving that block, which we were not able to save this building, but we were able to wipe it out totally and cut the fire off and save the entire block, which was a good job. And that was on January 13th, 1961. We had other bad fires too during my time of service, some before I was chief and some afterwards. A few of those to be remembered was the White Furniture Company fire on Lothbury Avenue, which was in 1954. Then we had the Sturchy Brother buildings down on 19th Street in Cumberland, December 28th, 1952. And of course, then we had a real bad fire in what was known as the Ginsburg building down on the corner of 19th Street and Cumberland Avenue, February 1961. And then the Schultz building, known as the Dixie Dollar Store was housed there, and then the Smith Electric building was in this same building or adjacent to it. We had those fires. So we had a tremendous number of bad fires concerning at least my last 10 years. And then I remember we had the old Yellow Creek Church fire, which was a bad one during that time. We practically lost that building out on West Winchester Avenue near the junction, and they rebuilt it back and have a nice building there. And then that helped bring on, of course, the need for more equipment and more men, which the city was tremendously nice with me and cooperated with me and in the procedure of getting the equipment and the type of equipment that I felt that we needed to give good fire protection and to give, make lives more safer and for our schools and businesses and all to have protection that they needed.
Well, now, how have requirements to be a fireman changed over the years?
It has changed tremendously because there is better school, fire schools that are given, better training schools, and there is more money whereby that men that are interested in the firefighting fields can go to school at the expense of the city furnishing the money or under programs of which the government will help out now more than they did then. At the time that, in my years of service, at the time that I started, we were only able to attend fire school college once a year at Lexington, the University of Kentucky. I was there every year for a number of years, for so many weeks per year, and that was all the city paid our expenses, and the state paid for the training of the school that furnished the instructors. And since that time, though, as the cities have grown and as the state has advanced tremendously, now many more can go at one time to school, and the city will furnish their transportation up there and pay their bills while they're there attending these schools each year, and they can send as many men as they deem necessary to send each year. So they're learning more, and there's more and more knowledge each year in because of new equipment and new type of firefighting equipment and firefighting chemicals that we have. We had to train, and we did train then, and much more they do now in the different types of fires that we fought. There had to be different types of chemicals used, such as gasoline fires. Water did not do them very much good into extinguishing the fire. But still, you had to use water pressure for the cooling purposes. We had some fires in book planture, which did not amount to too much because we were able to cool the outsides of the book planks down, these big tanks, to lower the pressure of the fumes. See, liquid gasoline does not burn as a liquid. It the heat of the fires causes the fumes to come forth, and the fumes is actually what burns. And the more the fire you have, the greater the fumes. So you must cool your capacity of the liquid gas down, and the fumes will automatically begin to fall. And then when they do, the blaze begins to lower down to whereby that you can use the firefighting chemical of foam, which will blanket this fire and smother it out. A way of firefighting of different types of fires. Of course, we have what we call the fire triangle, which consists of what you have to have before you can have a fire. You've got to have oxygen full of fuel and then the fire to ignite. And of course, you take away either of those and your fire is out. But then there are certain chemicals for certain type of cars, and it's how you approach them. And some gets out of hand, and you really can't do much with them because it's too dangerous. But we have had one thing in Middleburg, as far as my knowledge is concerned, we haven't ever lost a man in fighting fire. We've had a few injuries in my early days in one fire before I was, well, I worked as a captain, but I worked and fought just as hard with my men and lead them as I did, as I would if I didn't. I didn't really have to, but I did. And I, in the White Printer Company fire, we had a fire there one morning, and we set up our hose lines, and this fire had begun in the combustion materials in the storage room, where they had not cleaned out their papers and things before by a furniture had been shipped in, and somehow a fire caught in that and sprayed it upward to the roof. And I was on the ladder on the hose line with the nozzle to fight this fire, to try to bring it, smother it down from within, to bring it down on me. And as I was on the ladder, at the top of the ladder, and the fire coming out, beginning to fight, and my nozzle open, and pressure on the hose, and me on the top of the ladder, suddenly the heat from this fire just raised this roof, and this is an explosion type thing, and threw these blazes out in my face. And I suddenly closed my nozzle too quick. I knew not to do it, but under this thing that happens, we are only humans. And I closed my nozzle too quick, and the back pressure just threw me ladder and all back, completely back on my concrete there, and knocked me out, broke my arm, and because I went out like a lad, I knew nothing for a while until they got me to the hospital and all, but that was about all I got out of it. That happened, I think, mostly because through my subconsciousness, I guess I was trying to catch two. But the pressure was what really knocked me off, because the backhammer of the water, when you've got pressure at 110 or 115 pound cushion there, and you suddenly cut it off, you know, it would naturally do that. That's the only thing that happened to me, and others, firemen, some were overcome by smoke a few times, but one was knocked off of a building with a broken leg. Other than that, we've been real fortunate in Middleburg.
Well, you keep mentioning it, you keep calling the fire department the Middleburg Fire Department. Now, does Bell County have its own fire department? Is that the situation?
Middleburg Fire Department is a local city fire department. It's maintained and paid and all by the city of Middleburg. Now, city of Pineville has their local fire department, but there is no county fire department at all. Now, there has been talk, and I've been reading from the county judge and others, where they have been anticipating or talking about trying to have a county fire department. Now, we as cities, we have answered many fires in the counties, and Pineville does the same way, other cities does the same way, but those usually, unless it is in an extreme case, at least when I was with the city of Middleburg, we would answer calls, and then we would send them bills for it, and they would pay a certain minimum bill for the service that they had received from the local fire department outside the city, which I always pushed for that to be done, because I did not feel it was fair for the citizens of Middleburg to pay and maintain a fire department and give service to people outside that were not paying for it when actually I didn't feel it was exactly right. And so they did, but it was always a minimum. It was never anything overcharged or anything. It was a minimum charge. As to what they're doing now, I'm not sure about it.
Well, I've got one more question on the fire department. I was just noticing, you know, when you drive in, there's all these forests right here around this city. Have you ever had any problem with forest fires in this area that, you know, would come right in and affect the town?
We have fought many fires, and they still do major fires within the forest, and especially we have the Coming Gap National Park, and we have Pine Mountain Park, of course, and anywhere that they is a need or called upon, they do answer and furnish men equipment without leaving the city wide open without any fire protection. Of course, it is always as to number that they feel feasible without leaving the city, you know, without the proper fire protection. But I did many times in the local parks, fires would get out by citizens on the boundary line, maybe burning off a garden or in the fall of something and spread, and we would go to them and help them.
Now, is there any other history of the fire department that you'd like to tell about? Anything you think that's been left out?
I believe that I've pretty well covered it. There, of course, may be many minor things that I could have thought of or could have came to mind. I don't believe they would be important this time. I feel like that as the years go by and as the city's population increases, of course, there will have to be an additional housing departments built, or additional fire stations, which we call substations, will have to be built in other parts of town, such as we have one west end, we'll probably have to have one in the northern part of the section of Englandtown section, probably one in the west end, or in the east end of town, near probably the park. It will, as the city grows, the demands, of course, will be demanded, and these things are brought about where they have to do it, because pressure concerning insurance and insurance rating bureaus, because if a city, there are small cities and counties without fire protection, their insurance rates are tremendously more than they are within the city. I don't know the rates, what they are now within the city per $100, nor neither do I know in the county, because I haven't kept up with that. But I would say that they are 100% more in the county per rate per $100 than it would be in the city. Because, of course, insurance companies writes insurance on what they call or what they figure is a liability, whereby that they would have to pay if there was a fire, and it could be a minor thing, it could be put out and with no protection to put it out, and then it would be a complete loss. Also, industry coming to town or coming to any locality always find out first what fire protection they have, what police protection they have, and of course they get into the other things too, but we are talking today about police and fire protection, and they will not locate where these things are not available to them and where the record of their protection or their ability to serve has to be up around 100% too. Credibility there concerning the protection from of how interested or how good fire protection is, what kind of men you have, how interested they are, what kind of job they're doing. Same way by their protection, of course, through the police department from, you know, being robbed of thieves or breaking into the vandalism and different things like that.
Mr. Urie, you've mentioned the park. That's the Cumberland Gap National Park that you're referring to, isn't it?
Yes, ma'am, the historical park. It's the Cumberland Gap National Historical Park.
Well, now, what connection have you had with this?
Well, I have, of course, been in Middlesbrough, and knowing the beginning of the purchasing of land for the park and the Chamber of Commerce officials and city officials and different state officials and federal officials over the period of years buying the property. And of course then going on progressing into buildings and the administration building and certain other things that they have done, and of course it has brought additional employment, of course, to this section of the country also. The park officials live here, and of course they their duty is here in and with the city and in the entire park area. I have seen land being purchased partials by partials within the city and without the city limits and into the county. I've worked with the park officials in fire protection. We have fought some fires in the park area. We have given full protection to the buildings and properties from our firefighting units within the city. I have taken part prior to this in the dedication of the park when the President of the United States, as Vice President then, came to Middlesbrough, landed at the local airport, and the convoy which was led by the local police force and the FBI protection agencies and all to the park center where the dedication of the park was made by Vice President Nixon and the Secretary of Interior and other officials from Washington was here. It has been a great interest. It was a great personal blessing to me to be part of that and to be able to visit with those people and have a letter commending us for the protection and so on that we gave to the federal officials as they were here. And then beyond that, to enjoy the park facilities, of which I personally have enjoyed with my family and have met visitors there and have had our own kindred from other states to come to the local park area and to visit the museum and to take part is an enjoyable thing, and I think it would be a blessing and will be a blessing to all that will come our way and will visit the park and tour the whole entire park area, which is not only the park center, but the Hensley settlement area that is being made possible for visitors, and of course the Cumlin Mountain Pinnacle and areas within the campsite over on the Virginia side will all be enjoyed by those who have already visited and those who will visit in the future. So we invite everyone to come our way.
Well, now just how did they go about getting this park started? Who was behind it?
The local citizens of Middlesboro, especially through the Chamber of Commerce and the local mayor and city commissioners at that present time, Mr. Howard Douglas, a local Chamber of Commerce president that was here for years, was very instrumental in working in Washington through and by the then former Senator Barkley, many senators and congressmen down through the years that the local citizens were able to meet with, and the political leaders, and get bills passed through Congress appropriating money for buying the park property and for the building of the buildings and for any other needs that were needed, and which now they are working hard, the citizens are, of Middlesboro, the city officials, the Chamber of Commerce officials, that I read from what they are doing through the local papers now, and how that they are meeting with the state senators and the United States senators and United States congressmen, and where that we feel the assurance that pretty soon the tunnel, of which they are now trying to get in the process of being built through the Cumlin Mountain, will be a great asset also and a great interest to Middlesboro and to visitors which are on vacations, and tourists which are desiring to tour will come and see. So we hope that will soon be done by the officials.
How long did it take to get the park established?
To my knowledge, the park from the beginning until the establishment, I would say, was a hard work of at least 2 to 3 decades by men that was interested in making this a tourist center.
When was the dedication?
The exact year, not sure. I would have to go back to my files to find out, but it was when ex-President Nixon was vice president under General Dwight Eisenhower. And I believe it was in the late 40s or the early 50s.
Okay, what about the finances? Now, has this brought in a large amount of tourist trade thus far, or is that something to be worked for?
Oh yes, I think it has. The tourist trade, I feel, has been great, not having the knowledge of the amount or how much it would be, but feeling by the tourist that comes in, the hotels and the motels, feels rewarding part of the tourists by them staying in the hotels and motels, and of course by the restaurants, of which they would have lunches and so on, and then of course there you have to take in consideration the gasoline and oils and services that would be given by the service stations and to those that are traveling by automobile. I feel that it is rewarding to the city. I would say it would run into thousands of dollars each year.
Thank you very much, Mr. Urey, for this interview.